Peter Matheson is here. He is a co-founder of the Parish Review, along with George Plimpton. He is the author of over 20 books. He writes about vanishing cultures, oppressed people, wildlife, and the rest. His work includes Far Tortuga, The Snow Leopard, and the critically acclaimed Killing Mr. Watson. In his latest effort, he reconstructs the character of Mr. Watson in a sequel, Lost Man's River. I am pleased to have him back at this table. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Tell me, this is the Everglades?
Well, that's the idea.
It's a bit romantic with the moon and the reflection. But, you know, it has that quality. They're very strong, big rivers that come down out of the glades. And it's very wild. It's the biggest roadless area in the United States.
The biggest what?
Roadless, yeah. It is. People don't realize that.
Have you been down there?
Oh, lots. Yeah, I've camped there.
The story of your father?
I was going up the coast, the west coast of Florida, with my dad, and he didn't know much about the story. He just said, there's a river here, and he showed me on the chart. And he said, up that river is the only house in the Everglades that belongs to a guy, belonged to a guy called Watson, who apparently killed Belle Starr, the outlaw woman, and a lot of other people, too, and was killed by his neighbors. And I just found that, you know, somebody killed by his neighbors when they're not in the next cell block or something is a rather unusual event. And you say, how does this happen? And especially, he didn't know any more than that, but I started researching it. And I discovered that these people really liked him, and he was married three times. He had seven kids. All these people loved him. And a couple of mistresses who also had kids, they all loved him, and they put 33 bullets in him. So it was a very enigmatic situation, and all the more so because by rumor, and there's some reason to believe it at least, the first guy to shoot at him was a black man, Henry Short. If you remember, 1910, Jim Crow was at its most virulent, and the very idea of a black guy even being in that group, let alone raising a gun against somebody like Watson, is so incredible. If this happened, it's a kind of heraldic event in our culture. This is the underlying uneasiness in our Constitution, this whole business of racism. And it seemed to me an extraordinary metaphor, and it tied in all of my interests, the environment, American Indian people. They the Seminole Miccosukee, about the wildest they were for a long time. They weren't defeated, and they still have their own language, which very few Indian groups do. And so that whole region, I wanted to put it all together, and Watson was going to be a very minor thread in the whole fabric. And it became like a strangler fig. It just took over everything. And not only did it take over everything, it became about a 2,000-page book.
So it's a trilogy now.
It never was a trilogy, really. It's really all one novel, but it has three kind of movements. And I had to split it up because it was just too long. But it's obsessed me for 15 years at least.
How much research did you do? Or you just take the story and run with it?
I took the story and ran with it because there were very, very few hard facts. All I had were gravestones and census records and then legend and myth, which was all very blown up and exaggerated. And I really think this is the closest to the truth that anybody's ever come. His own family didn't even have a picture of him. They'd never seen him. I actually discovered through a branch in the family. I came across a picture. Now I've come across two. But it was fascinating. I talked to everybody over 95 in Southwest Florida, I guess, at one point or another.
Would you walk up to him and say, what do you know about Watson?
Pretty much, because he is still a myth. My daughter-in-law, who was raised in Brooklyn, Italian-American family, she said when she was a kid, she wouldn't go to bed. This is what her folks said. They said, you get in bed or Mr. Watson will get you. So he, at that time, was a very famous bogeyman. Interesting. I find this fascinating because he was not a criminal type. He wasn't a serial killer or anything like that, but he did kill a few people, no question about that. But he also maybe, I think he did, developed the strain of sugar cane, which became the foundation of the whole Florida big sugar industry. Now that's interesting for a guy who's supposed to be a murderer and a killer. So everything about him is curious and interesting.
So you incorporate that all in here.
Yeah.
What happens in the next movement then? Did you sit down and write the 2,000 pages at one time and then one continuous stretch?
Yep, I did.
And then how did you divide it up?
Well, I took, it's kind of like movements. This one, I mean, Killing Mr. Watson, the first one was really points of view of his neighbors and his children, how they saw him going up and carrying up to the point where he is blown away, literally, by his neighbors. And he kind of, you know, kind of tried to bluff it out. The second book, this one here, is by from the point of view of his son Lucius 50 years later, who loves his dad, who cannot believe these terrible stories, and it tries to find out the real truth. And he goes back and interrogates the people. They're very leery of him, naturally. He's a very good shot, too. And they think maybe...
He's been on revenge.
Yeah, and there's a lot of tension there. And he goes, and he even interviews Henry Short, who's this black guy, and he, you know... And he tries to piece it together from his point of view. The third one will be from Mr. Watson's point of view, right from his childhood until the time he realizes he's made a very bad miscalculation. Now,
does he die? Does Watson in the third one die looking at the barrel of the gun that's
pretty
faced?
I think right now, but I think I'll take him right up to the last second, yeah.
Last second?
Yeah.
And does the shot go between his eyes or where?
Well, I have a little leeway on that one, Charlie. I don't have to. I'm going to play with that for a while. You know, in a way, it's kind of all along, since the facts aren't known and there are so many mysterious things, like Henry Short, for example, and the very other things which are quite interesting. And did the mob lynch him? Or were they, in other words, were they preparing to kill him when he came in? Or did they, as they say, go in self-defense because he raised a shotgun against them? The people who were part of the crowd say it was self-defense. The people who are watching say that they were laying for him. So all, and this is, and may I say, this is still a hot argument down in this part of the world.
Yeah. Why the title Lost Man's River?
That's a general region. That's kind of the wildest region of the Everglades. It comes down into the Gulf, Lost Man's River, and out of the glades. And I like those words together. I seem to be drawn to river titles. I think that's the fourth one.
And what will be the title of the next book?
The last one. Well, I have two work titles.
Mr. Watson's Inn.
Watson 3. Yeah. I don't think either one of them will make the cut, but I like the kind of heraldic frontier quality of The Man Who Killed Bell Starr. But that sounds too much like a movie. And then I was working with an Emily Dickinson, a wonderful Emily Dickinson poem. And the phrase "bone by bone," which, you know,
is this a movie?
The first one has been optioned, but I don't think they're doing anything with it, so I don't know. I'm kind of hoping that the whole thing will be done at once.
The dread of something after death, the undiscovered country, from whose bourne no traveler returns, makes us rather bear those ills we have than fly to others that we know not of.
Well, that comes from Shakespeare, of course.
Hamlet,
there it's Hamlet,
two.
But it's Hamlet 3, and it's a big typo there.
Oh, that's exactly yeah. 3, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I was going to call the book The Undiscovered Country, because I thought that, and I'm glad I didn't now, because the book has just come out recently, not a novel, I don't think, but I saw that title recently. But The Undiscovered Country had this kind of, had said a lot about the Everglades, about the undiscovered country of the mind, about how do we know about these people who are human beings and so alive. And this guy was jolly. He was a great storyteller. And,
it begins with the deposition of Bill W. House, October 27, 1910. My name is William Warlick House, residing at Chokoloski Island in Lee County, Florida. And he goes on. Your life seems to have had a guardian angel for the most part. You agree with that?
I think I'm very lucky in my life, yeah.
Father was an architect.
Mm-hmm.
Lived in Connecticut.
Right.
You went to Yale.
I went to Yale.
I think my
folks, I don't think that they would have chosen that I become a writer, but they certainly were encouraging and open to it. You know, they were very leery that I might write about them. In fact, the first couple of books made them very nervous and unhappy. And they were wrong, but people always think you're writing about them, so you can't help it.
Published early.
My first story was when I was at Yale. I sold to the Atlantic Monthly. Yeah.
Long association with the New Yorker?
Mm-hmm. Many, many years. Yeah.
National Book Award?
Yeah.
For The Snow Leopard?
Yeah, a couple others. One of the novels was nominated too.
Snow Leopard won, though, didn't it?
Snow Leopard won, yeah.
Right. It's not your best book, in your judgment.
Let me say this. I think The Snow Leopard is fine, but The Snow Leopard, in a way, has been a kind of a nail in my fictional coffin.
Why?
Well, because it's the book so closely associated with me, and people sort of say, why does he write fiction? But I think my fiction is the heart of my work.
You know, you think that you will be remembered in time.
I do.
For your fiction.
Now, maybe I'm just whistling in the dark here, but I don't think so. First, I began as a short story writer. I wrote about 30 short stories before I wrote any nonfiction. My first four books were novels. Not very good novels, I confess, but nonetheless, but the stories were being published. And, and then it was kind of a financial decision. I was a commercial fisherman, and I was doing that in addition to my writing, and I had a new wife and young kids, and I really had to make some money. So I went over into writing nonfiction about what I knew about boats and wild places and wildlife and stuff.
You fished during the summer, right in the winter.
Yeah, yeah. But then I got Mr. Shaw of The New Yorker agreed to send me around the world to all the wild places. I said, Mr. Shaw, everybody's writing about Europe, but who's writing about all these wonderful wildernesses that are going down the tube? Let's have some. And he agreed, and I rushed off to South America before he could change his mind. So that really was the beginning of that, and that produced a nonfiction book and a fiction book, and that encouraged my interest in Indian people. I've always been very interested in traditional people, and I really could have been a certain kind of anthropologist, because I'm so interested in how they work and how they relate to the world, you know. And I'm not much interested, I guess, in at least I'm much less interested in urban, you know. So I like these people on the edge, like these ones, you know.
Yeah, but your best friends are writers, aren't they?
Not all of them. Nope. I've had the painters and sculptors.
But they're creative people who live in urban areas, for the most part.
Mostly they are. Yeah, and I like them. I mean, I enjoy people. You know, your conversation, everything, you have to be a little bit more, how should we say, entertaining and. But maybe not even, because, you know, I like, American Indians and these people here, they really, I have a good time with them. They make me laugh. They really do. They have a laconic, gritty humor, which really makes me laugh. When I was a commercial fisherman working with these guys, I did a book on them, too, and they're really in the same situation as these people. They're being forced out of their traditional livelihood, forced off their own land. The young people can't afford to live where their people have lived forever. And I find this really kind of sad. We're not taking care of these folks. And they're the ones who, in a way, provide the flavor. You know, people go to the Hamptons. And they like the Hamptons because of those beautiful farms.
Right.
And the atmospheric fishing, too. Yeah. And, you know, and fish traps, and the fish, and the boats going offshore, and the guys going along the beach, and the Holsteins. But the same people were really forcing those guys right off the land. I mean, they can't afford to fish and farm on land that's worth that much, and let alone live there or buy. And yet they were the ones who came in 60. They take up service jobs, you know, janitors and lawnmowers and house painters, and they're very handy guys. They can do a lot of things, but they really love to fish.
Well, did you really love to fish?
Yeah, I did. I really did. I love that life. The combination of very hard physical work, you know, rowing in a dory, putting dories into the ocean.
Did you read The Perfect Storm?
I did.
Did you like it?
I liked it very much.
Because it just rang true?
It rang true because I've been close enough to seas like that, and it just filled me with that chill, that terrible chill of fear.
The fear that we're going down. Boy, we are not going home.
Well, it's not so much not going home. You don't even care about that after a certain point. You just want to
land.
Make sure you're still breathing. I mean, I don't know. I found it hair-raising. I liked it. And also, I was pleasantly surprised by the quality of the writing. I thought it was... A lot of those books aren't very well written, and I thought that one really was. I think it's his first book, too.
Yeah, it was. How about Cold Mountain? Have you read that?
I've just started it. I hear very good things about it.
Yeah, it's a good book. Good, interesting. First novel, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's also, you like it because of what it does about the land.
I think, from what I sense, he sees the land as a character, and I do,
that's
too.
Right. No, he does.
Yes.
And in fact,
the land is right there with you all the time.
Exactly. And that's where he's going. It's what's drawing him back.
Yeah.
You know, it can't
I like that. I like, you know, I'm a, I think I'm, I like storytelling. And storytelling is as old as human nature, you know. And I think we, I think writers, we move away from story. This is very different than plot. Plot is tricky and it's arranging stuff, but story, a real story, like the Indians say, the winter count, the winter tales that you save for winter and you don't tell any other time of year. You know, I think that's so important, and you want to hear about these kind of, and I think they should be mysterious, you know.
If you just look at the blurb on your book, and it's a, I mean, Thomas Pynchon, come on. It's Dryden. Jim Harrison, Tom McGuane, Carlos Fuentes, and on. What common denominator do most good writers have?
That's a very interesting question. I don't know. I do know. I mean, I think I kind of know. I think there has to be an element in really good writing. There has to be an element. It has to be kind of intact. It doesn't depend on, for example, I have an aversion to using trade names in my stuff because I don't want to depend on anything for a quick identification on the part of the reader. They have to, I make them work a little too hard, maybe. It has to be complete in itself. And it has to have a mystery in it. A sense of something mysterious. Even though you never spell it out, you don't say this is mysterious. But I think the reader has to feel in the presence of something they cannot quite define. And the poet, Rilke, he spoke about that we haven't the courage of certain experiences that we call supernatural because we have no vocabulary for them. But something like that, something that's just kind of implicitly there. And some writers move right into that, and they're very daring with that element. But I think that almost all good writing has that mystery and strangeness somewhere in there.
If you had to take one last trip, if I had to say to you, it's not going to be long for you, Peter.
Well, that's probably true.
You can take one last trip. Where would you go?
Well, I'm going to Antarctica in January, but I don't think that would be the last one.
Well, I hope not the last one, but I mean, this curiosity you have for the frontier,
yeah,
wherever it is.
I think the region that draws me, because I've been around it. I've been at Lake Baikal, and I've been in Mongolia, and I've been in the Tibetan Plateau. It's that desert, the desert mountains of Central Asia. I think that, for some reason, that very mysterious region draws me.
Is it the mystery that draws you, or is it something else?
Well,
the starkness of it, or the beauty of it,
it's the beauty, but it has animals, sort of heraldic animals. You know, the tiger's range kind of circles it, and I'm doing a book on cranes, the cranes of the world, 15 species of cranes, and a lot of them are there. The snow leopard is certainly all around the edges of it. I don't know, and it has a great tradition, the Mongols, and everything about it is odd and strange. I don't know, maybe under the Soviets, they probably hammered it. I know that the capital of Mongolia is terrible, these wonderful Buddhist temples and then these architectural horrors. I know enough about architecture to know bad, it's really, So I don't know what's left there, but Mongolia, excited me. I found that we had an expedition to Far Eastern Mongolia.
Tom Brokaw came back from not long ago, and he said that the horsemanship was just amazing,
incredible.
Just incredible.
Incredible, it is.
And they could
it
ride
is.
For 20 miles.
Oh, yeah, no problem. But horsemanship, look at our American Indian people. I mean, those guys, to think they only had the horse about 20 or 30 years. They didn't have the horse very long, And in that very short period, I think less than half a century or something, they became these extraordinary horsemen. I think when you're raised in that culture and you're on a horse from the time you're 2 years old, it's a big difference. It's like doing anything from that age. You're one with a horse. It's very exciting.
You love the land. You love to travel. You love to write about nature.
Yeah.
And you have, at some point, discovered this great love affair, or at least respect, for Native Americans.
I always have. They appear in my very first book. My very first novel has an American Indian, victim. They're our land. We spend a lot of energy worrying about human rights all over the world, but we never pretty remiss in our own country. So I think they tend to be forgotten. We have to keep, you know, bringing that situation forward. You know, we're always talking, hammering other people.
Leonard Peltier case about?
Leonard is a young Sioux Ojibwa Anishinaabe guy, and he was in the American Indian Movement, and he was really working with Dennis Banks at that time. And they had a shootout on Pine Ridge Reservation, and two FBI agents were killed. And it was a terrible event, no question about that. There was a young Indian guy killed, too. He's never mentioned at all. And Leonard's done 22 years. There were four people indicted. The other three were acquitted. If he'd been there and tried with them, he'd have been acquitted, too. But they switched to another judge, and they prosecuted and convicted him on first-degree murder. But now they admit, the U.S. Attorney's Office has admitted, they don't know who shot the agents. And his own judges have come forward and said this man's sentence should be commuted. 22 years is enough. He was a part of a whole big group of young Indians, and he had no record of violence before this. I mean, it's ironic to say, but even if they could prove that he had been the shooter, he served enough time under those circumstances. It's only because they had nobody else that the FBI won't relent. They just won't relent, and the old guard in the FBI. I saw a wonderful article about Louis Freeh the other day, and I thought, my gosh,
why? Cover the New York Times Magazine.
Right. And I thought, why don't these people take advantage of this opportunity to extend, when his own judges want compassion extended to him? This is a chance for the FBI to soften that kind of image. And, you know, they're not, every time they get in the paper, it's something awful. Why not get in the paper for something?
Compassion.
Yeah, really.
What you're saying is deserved.
Yeah, indeed. So,
pardon.
Well, a commutation, you know, I'm not a commutation, but the president can pardon him at any time, but he won't do it unless the Justice Department does it, and the FBI is holding up the Justice Department. Right. You know.
Lost Man's River, Peter Matheson, a novel by the author of Killing Mr. Watson. By the way, Mr. Matheson says that his best book is fiction, and it is called For Tortuga.
Yes, sir.
Why?
Maybe because I had the most fun writing it. It was experimental. I got rid of all the he saids and she saids. I used white space. I got rid of similes and metaphors for the most part. And it just kind of challenged me. And the curious thing is, it excited other writers too. It was a kind of a, and it had, I hope it had those qualities that I'm talking about, of A, being a complete world in itself, and also being very strange.
And there's some story I read about you once in which you wrote something and you sent it off to somebody, maybe a teacher, maybe an editor, and they wrote back and said, this is not bad. Unfortunately, Jane Fenimore Cooper did it. He did it, and it was much better.
That's right. That was my first agent. She said, James, Bernice Baumgarten, yeah. She was married to a writer called James Gould Cousins, and she was very tough, but she was great.
Unfortunately,
that's a whole note. Dear Peter, James Fenimore Cooper wrote this 150 years ago, only he wrote it better. Yours, Bernice.
Lost Man's River, Peter Matheson. We'll be right back. Stay with us.